freedom is not enough.
It's been 45 years since LBJ signed the Civil Rights Act, but even now, do we know its limits?
Freedom is not enough. You do not wipe away the scars of centuries by saying now, you are free to go where you want. Now do as you desire and choose the leaders you please.
But if freedom is not enough, what will it take? Minority groups are flexing their voting muscles to get some movement in the healthcare debate.
The rage is relentless. We need a movement with the quickness. You are the witness of change and the counteract. We gotta take the power back.
It's hard to get as excited about healthcare as we do about freedom, but we'll try on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Thursday, October 8th. I'm Celeste Headlee here with John Hockenberry.
Good morning, Celeste. Also this hour, we're going to explore one of the most popular subjects for amateur investigators, genealogy. And this morning, the New York Times is shaking up Michelle Obama's family tree. Also, liberation theology for electrical devices, power without wires. It's the holy grail of high tech.
But first, Kathleen Hall Jamison is director of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. Civil rights groups are trying to convince Americans that affordable health care is a human and civil right. So, Kathleen, is this new push enough to sway the debate on health care?
No, those who already are disposed to believe it have accepted the need for reform. Those who aren't going to be persuaded by that assertion.
That's tough. Kathleen Hall Jamison, stay with us. We're going to talk more about it in a moment. Right now, everything else you need to know this morning.
Well, in the headlines, the Congressional Budget Office has a new cost estimate for the Senate Finance Committee's health care reform bill. It puts the bill at $829 billion over a decade. That's below President Obama's cost target. The committee could now vote on the bill as soon as tomorrow. In Afghanistan, at least 17 are dead after a car bomb exploded this morning in Kabul. The blast took place outside the Indian embassy. Many more are injured. The Taliban claims responsibility.
That's as President Obama's national security team debates a new strategy in Afghanistan. Our partner, the New York Times, reports some advisors want to change the focus to Al-Qaeda in neighboring Pakistan. The news comes after a high-level strategy meeting yesterday. And German author, born in communist Romania, is the winner of the Nobel Prize for Literature. Herta Mueller moved to Germany after officials in her native land censored her work. Back in the U.S., our partner, the New York Times, also reports that areas hit hard by H1N1 or swine flu last spring are not seeing large resurgence. That's a potential sign that immunity is growing in those areas. And some new economic data will be out this hour. We'll learn the number of people filing for new unemployment benefits. New numbers from the Congressional Budget Office, by the way, show that the U.S. deficit tripled from last year. It's now at a record $1.4 trillion. Well, the market on Wall Street was basically flat yesterday. The Dow opened up at 97.26. The S&P starts trading at 10.58. And the NASDAQ starts at 21.10. All this week, we've been marking the eighth year that America has been fighting in Afghanistan. And we want to hear your stories. How has it affected your life? How has your opinion changed 8 years into this war in Afghanistan? And should we send in more troops or bring them home? What's more, what's the mission in Afghanistan? Are you able to tell us what it is? 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning, everyone. Good morning, Celeste. You
know,
you played that Lyndon Johnson cut there at the top and talked to
right.
Kathleen Hall Jamison right there. You know, it's amazing to me how remote the discussion of civil rights is in America from the perspective of today. It was so with us in 1965. It seems so remote in the healthcare debate right now.
Yeah, well, it is remote from the healthcare debate, and the fact that many of us are just now beginning to discuss whether or not healthcare is a civil right is probably surprising to a lot of people. But that's exactly what's happening. I mean, all summer we've heard angry voices at these town halls. We've heard irritated legislators responding. We even heard Senator Rockefeller break down into tears over the public option. But what we have not heard, as you said, is minority groups, and that's pretty surprising considering the gigantic disparity in healthcare coverage between whites rights and minorities. So now these groups are coming forward. They're trying to make their voices heard in the debate.
I mean, the question is it a Brown versus Board of Education kind of an issue, kind of a disparity?
Well, if it is, that would definitely motivate people,
indeed,
wouldn't it?
Indeed.
Joining us now is Hillary Shelton, the NAACP's Senior Vice President for Advocacy and Policy and Director of its Washington Bureau. We're also joined by Jennifer Nondo, Deputy Director of Health Policy at the National Council of La Raza. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
So one of the things that I at least was reading about this healthcare debate was that people were trying to steer it away from the issue of race. The president of La Raza's National Council said we should be able to win this fight on the merits of the case and the facts themselves, and we should keep race out of it. So why is that changing now, Hillary?
It's not that it's changing. It's always been the case that we have to look at how the health care dilemma in our country affects so many different communities. We are a nation of many different communities, of races, ethnicities, and other differences. And as such, we have to make sure that any health care approach fits those various communities. One size does not fit all. We want to make sure everyone is covered as we move in this direction.
So let's first establish, for those who maybe aren't aware of there's decades of research behind this particular issue, but let's talk about some of these statistics that really lay this out in very clear terms. I mean, some of these things are very stark. I was reading that breast cancer occurs more often in white women than in black women in the U.S., but it kills more black women than white. Black hospital patients are far less likely to survive heart attacks than white patients. And the large majority of black patients that went to hospitals had the poorest survival rate for cardiac arrest. Black and Hispanic preschoolers less likely to receive asthma medications than white kids. Minority residents of nursing homes in the same nursing home less likely to get glasses or hearing aids. And minority women wait twice as long as white women for follow-up tests after an abdominal mammogram. Those things seem just startling. Is this removed from the poverty? I mean, I know that a lot of these things are confused by low income, but is there a disparity in healthcare just based on race when you take poverty out of it?
Well, it's very difficult to take poverty out of it. The reality is that African Americans are disproportionately poor, and so are Hispanics in our country. The reality is that in addition to all the examples you just gave, if you get to that point, we still have African American children, Hispanic children dying at childbirth at a rate that's much higher than white American children these days. So indeed, the disparities are there at that level. But the debate right now is also over the issue of whether there'll be health care coverage indeed. So you're talking about the actual providing of health care services, and clearly that disparity is there. But very well, if we look at who's actually covered with health care insurance, we know that we have over 46 million Americans that have no health care insurance. And we know that disproportionately African Americans and Hispanics are uninsured. So indeed, as we move in this direction, you're absolutely right. The disparity is there. The racial disparity is clearly there. And we have to make sure that we have health care in America that covers everyone.
So Jennifer Nondo, you're with the National Council of La Raza. Why has it taken so long for your groups to get mobilized? I mean, the public option in the Senate Finance Committee died by 2 votes. Where were you when the public option needed you?
Actually, what I'll say about that is that our communities have been out there loud and strong across the summer. Over the summer, we've been activating communities to collect postcards. There's been hundreds of group stories pouring into our doors. Even just in the past few weeks, as the Senate Finance Committee was being heard, we've had 5,000 calls go in a collaborative with our partners. But when there's a voice that's speaking in a positive tone about advancing the process and integrating good things, there hasn't been as much coverage on those issues. And so what we'd say is, while we've taken a very civil tone in this debate, the louder, less civil voices have been more apparent in the media coverage.
Okay, Kathleen Hall-James, you're the director of Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. Listen to this cut.
We have been waiting for health reform since the days of Teddy Roosevelt. We've been waiting since the days of Harry Truman. We've been waiting since Johnson and Nixon and Clinton. We cannot wait any longer. There comes a time when the cup of endurance runs over. There comes a time to remember the fierce urgency of right now.
So that's President Obama speaking to the Congressional Black Caucus, channeling a little bit of MLK. Kathleen Hall Jamieson, can we succeed? Can anyone succeed at turning this into a civil rights argument that health care is a civil right?
You can certainly make the argument that disparities are based on forms of discrimination that mean that some segments of society, and those can be race tied, are essentially disenfranchised, not given access. But to translate that into a language of rights at this point of the debate is extraordinarily difficult. And you notice that in the clip from President Obama. He's talking about health reform as the right in that implicit statement. Reform isn't the right. If there's a right, it's access to affordable health care. He doesn't even have that rhetoric
right
down to argue for right. That's a problem underlying the debate. If you don't feel a sense of moral outrage when you hear the rhetoric, you don't go to right.
Well, Kathleen, this is the puzzle to me, it seems. Americans have deliberately, or the public discourse has deliberately stepped back from rights questions. We talk about market mechanisms in health care. I remember when the debate over the Americans with Disabilities Act happened, it was all about money and market. It was not about rights. Why has America's public forum stepped away from civil rights questions when the 14th Amendment, for heaven's sakes, is in the Constitution?
One of the problems in this debate is the presumption that non-citizens should not be covered all but eliminates discussion of rights.
Wow.
If it's a right, it's fundamental. Humans are entitled, and something very problematic occurs when the right is denied. So you start out by saying, and virtually everybody on the public stage is saying that some people who are human and are here are not entitled. You can't then assert it as a right.
So, Jennifer Nandu with the National Council of La Raza, we spoke with a few other people in this debate. They were saying that for minorities, the public option is the only way to solve the racial disparities. Do you agree with that?
Well, we have said and come together as organizations and said that the public option is critically important. We think it's an important cost containment measure. But there are other elements that we need to address to ensure that equity is carried across the space of healthcare reform. That means that we need a culturally and linguistically appropriate system that takes steps, tangible steps, to eliminate healthcare disparities, discrimination, and improve health access and quality in our system.
So, Hillary Shelton with the NAACP, your group has started this campaign called 880, and you're talking about the deaths of 880,000 people of color that could have been prevented if they had passed some kind of health care reform in the last decade. And I would imagine that for many people that would be very motivating, but polls also show that for non-minorities, for whites, the healthcare debate, that kind of thing doesn't reach them, that they're not as invested in healthcare as say the minority communities are. So how do you move these groups that aren't motivated by that kind of argument?
Well, very well, if you also look at the issue of minorities, when you talk about minority health at the federal level, you're talking about also white ethnic groups, too, those who live in Appalachia, that work in coal mines and others. I think that very well we have to do a better job of making sure we recognize how this affects the various communities throughout our society. When people see that this very well affects us as well, we talk about health care and providing more hospital beds in given areas, our rural areas, and many of our inner city areas, as we've seen, many of our public hospitals close, and the need for additional health care along those lines, I think people will begin to see how this will affect each and every one of us in our country, those of us who have health care insurance. Because don't forget, this health care debate is not just about making sure that those who are uninsured become insured. It's also about making sure that those who have insurance have adequate insurance, and that very well their doctors have the opportunity to make the final decision instead of the insurance companies.
Okay, that was Hillary Shelton, and the NAACP Senior Vice President for Advocacy and Policy, Director of its Washington Bureau. We also spoke with Jennifer Nandu, Deputy Director of Health Policy at the National Council of La Raza. And thanks to Kathleen Hall Jamieson, Director of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. Weigh in on this issue at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
That was really interesting.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Hey,
Hey, you want that to go?
And now some quick takeouts on stories we want you to stay on top of this week. The big headline down in Washington is about health care. The Congressional Budget Office has come in with its numbers on the Senate Finance Committee's health care bill. Yes, the bill, according to the CBO, meets the requirement that it not add any money to the deficit, be deficit neutral. And according to the CBO, it might reduce deficits by a total of $81 billion over the decade starting next year. But that's the headline. Behind the headlines, Charlie Rangel, Democratic congressman, is fighting a rear guard action. Todd Zwillick, what's going on with Charlie Rangel?
Yeah, well, John, for close to a year, ethics charges have been haunting Charlie Rangel. Charlie Rangel's chairman of the powerful Ways and Means Committee in the House that controls taxes and trade and health care, Medicare, Medicaid. Medicare. Big jurisdiction. So Rangel's been investigated for ages. Now Republicans are trying to force him off of the Ways and Means Committee at a time when the committee has a lot of attention because of health care and taxes. Well, just real quick, some of the charges against Rangel: that he failed to disclose about $600,000 in assets on his congressional disclosure forms. He failed to pay taxes on property, including a villa in the Dominican Republic. He allegedly solicited donations to a school in his name at a community college in New York City, while the guy he was soliciting donations from had business worth hundreds of millions of dollars in front of the committee. So here was the scene yesterday on the House floor as Republicans tried to use procedural tactics on the floor to force Charlie Rangel off of his committee. Listen to this.
He somehow neglected to mention these accounts on his congressional disclosure forms, which means, if you can believe it, that he signed the forms and he did not notice that maybe $1 million was missing. Somebody ought to check the lighting in his office.
Representative John Carter, Republican of Texas, from a district wedge between Austin and Waco there, leading the charge against Rangel. So I caught up with Mr. Rangel after the vote. Now, remember, these charges have been mounting one after the other, and they've hung over him for close to a year. Here's Rangel.
I've been waiting patiently for the Ethics Committee to make a judgment. That's where it belongs, and it doesn't belong on the floor.
Well, John, Democrats are still supporting Rangel. The Speaker of the House says nothing will happen until the Ethics Committee makes a determination. Now, many people don't see how Rangel can get away unadmonished if it's true that he failed to pay taxes and failed to disclose hundreds of thousands of dollars of assets. I mean, he's chairman of the committee that writes the tax law, for God's sake. But one wrinkle, there have been other votes on this in the past. Republicans have tried to do this in the past, and no Democrat has ever voted for it. Straight party line votes. Yesterday, two conservative Democrats crossed over and did vote with the GOP. The GOP leadership says the Democratic veneer is starting to crack on this, but we'll have to see.
Well, to clarify, the vote was to send the charges to the committee, but it's really up to the committee. More drama yet for Congressman Charlie Rangel of New York. Thank you, Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent.
Now to Louise Story, finance reporter for our partners in New York Times. Louise, you broke a story this morning about Merrill Lynch. You discovered something about Merrill Lynch's bonuses. What's going on there?
Well, it's kind of hard to believe there's something about Merrill Lynch bonuses that we don't already know, because we've been talking about them so much. And in fact, when I found out that there was this other bonus plan that will pay out millions of dollars this next January, I thought, wow, this is going to really cause a lot of outrage because people are upset about Merrill bonuses.
They have backup bonuses at Merrill?
There's more money. But when I looked into it even further, I realized this was a more nuanced picture because actually this was a plan that was set up to pay for performance. It had skin in the game, clawbacks, all of these features that we're talking about now as solutions to the problem. And I thought, well, wait a minute. If Merrill had this a few years ago,
how come it didn't stop them?
Yes. And so it said to me, okay, are all these things that the regulators are looking at and the compensation czar in Washington, is it really going to change anything? Because
This didn't happen before.
Right. So I took this plan apart in great detail. You can see a graphic in the Times today that's very complex. I kind of feel like I did a massive homework assignment. And you can see it was very complex, but it didn't work to stop them from taking risks.
But it begs the question, do they now go back and after what we know of what happened over those 2 years, do we now go back and say, okay, you owe us several million dollars?
Well, guess what? In this plan, it had a clawback. They've already clawed back. So in 2007, when Merrill had a horrible year, these executives put in, for the top ones, they put in $2 million of their own money at the beginning of 2007. And at the end of 2007, after the bad year, they lost it. So they did claw back 07. But the reason they're still making money out of this plan is because it was a four-year plan. 06 was such a good year. And in 08, because they sold the company, that also helps them. So the good years outweigh the bad years in the end. Top executives at Merrill are losing a little, but less than ordinary shareholders. But the kind of second-tier executives, and there's a bunch of them, are making money.
Louise Story, finance reporter for our partner, the New York Times. A full article with the graph straight out of your econ class in college. There's a link. You can take a look at it at thetakeaway.org.
Well, Nando DeFino, Wall Street Journal sports reporter, has our final takeout this morning. You know, I call it October madness. The Yankees stomped Minnesota last night 7-2. RBIs for Matsui, RBIs for Jeter, RBIs for A-Rod. That was a great game if you were a Yankees fan, right, Nando?
Oh, yeah, it was. I mean, it's just exactly what you wanted. You know, your potential MVP candidate came through, and Hideki Matsui came to life.
And, you know, it certainly puts the lie to the idea that Minnesota in its playoff was playing right up to the edge there. They were ready. The Yankees had the time off, and so they were kind of sleepy. It didn't happen.
No, I mean, it's I don't know. You got to kind of feel bad for Minnesota. I mean, everyone's been there. You know, you've gone to bed at 3 in the morning and had to go to work at 8 o'clock the next morning. But the mindset is just, you know, they said they weren't tired. They said they wanted to go at it, and they gave it their best shot.
All right. Last night, the Dodgers beat the Cardinals 5-3 in Game 1 of the National League series, which got underway yesterday. This was a pretty dreadful game all the way around. There was some record that they broke.
You know, it's just the starting pitching was just it wasn't what they hoped it would be. And I think the story that's going to end up coming out of this one is that Jeff Weaver, who basically won the World Series in St. Louis a few years ago, beat them last night. He's just basically signed halfway through the season by L.A.
And 30 men left on base. That's the that's a record for a nine-inning game. Game 2 is today at 6 p.m. And tell me about the Philadelphia game. They took the defending champs took it from the Colorado Rockies, who were the wild card. There's a theory that the wild card team has more momentum. Didn't work out last night.
No, I mean, this is what happened 2 years ago when Colorado just swept everybody and they got killed in the World Series coming as the wild card. And I guess the Philly, they were prepared with Cliff Lee. He just shut them down. It was one of the most, I guess, well-pitched games you're ever going to see in the postseason, just how he broke them down totally. Yeah,
if you don't have a bullpen, just have your starters throw complete games. That's the solution.
It reduces the risk, yeah.
Game 2 today is at 2:30. Who are the pitchers?
You know, to be honest, I haven't looked that far
ahead. Cole Hamels and Aaron Cook, I believe. But what's going to tell the difference in this National League series? And we got two more to get to quickly.
The difference in this series is going to be the pitching, I think. Hamels is going to turn around and be like the Cole Hamels of old. And Colorado, if they want to win, their bats are going to have to come alive. They have to do something with that.
All right, well, we'll see what bats are alive when the Red Sox go after the Angels in Game 1 of their series. That's tonight. Who do you like?
You know, I have to like the Angels just because they've lost so many times to Boston. It's got to come around their way. They've lost 12 of the last 13 postseason series against Boston.
Nando DeFino, Wall Street Journal, talking about October baseball madness. Thanks, Nando.
Anytime, John.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Freeman Foundation.
Coming up, the Michelle Obama family tree. It's controversial for her and maybe interesting for Americans looking into their own family histories. Right now, let's check in on the top news stories at 32 minutes after the hour. Fresh economic data out just a couple of minutes ago. The Labor Department reports the number of Americans filing new jobless claims is 521,000. That's down about 33,000, and that should have a positive impact on the market when Wall Street gets underway in about an hour. Herta Mueller is this year's winner of the Nobel Prize in Literature. She's a German writer born in Romania. The Swedish Academy presents the prizes. Lars Bevinger is the Scandinavian correspondent for our partner, the BBC.
The Academy's permanent secretary said Ms. Mueller depicted the landscape of the dispossessed with the concentration of poetry and the frankness of prose. She struggled to publish her early work under the censorship of the then Romanian dictatorship of Nicolae Ceausescu and left for Germany in 1987. She now lives in Berlin. Herta Mueller is now invited to collect the $1.4 million prize at a ceremony in Stockholm in December. The award also usually means a dramatic rise in sales for the winner.
Lars Bevinger from our partner, the BBC.
On Capitol Hill, the Congressional Budget Office cost breakdown of the Senate Senate Finance Committee health care bill is now out. This clears the way for the Finance Committee to vote, maybe as soon as tomorrow. And speaking of D.C. number crunching, the U.S. budget deficit has tripled over the past year. It hit a record $1.4 trillion. Those are some of the news stories we're following this morning.
So, you know, so since public records started to migrate to the Internet, among the most popular things to do online is to search for family history and genealogical information. Here are some top genealogical sites online. You got Ancestry.com, Genealogy.com, RootsWeb.com, MyFamily.com. There's even like OBIT. Databases where you can search for the OBITs.
Yeah. And you have to keep them separate because there's not always great records of some of the immigrants who came in.
It differs from population to population. Right. Of course, the Mormons are famous for inspiring genealogical research in the United States. This morning, our partner, the New York Times, has a story about First Lady Michelle Obama that points up the popularity and availability of genealogical information, but also the sensitivity and challenges of searching for roots in some African-American families. Rachel Swarns is a Washington correspondent for our partner, the New York Times. So, Rachel, good morning. What's the headline?
Good morning. Well, we spent some time working with a genealogist looking back at Michelle Obama's family's roots in slavery. And what we found was the first link to the white ancestor in her family.
And it goes back how many generations?
So we were writing about her great-great-great-grandfather. And her great-great-great-grandmother, who was a slave girl in South Carolina, who ended up getting shipped to Georgia.
All right. Megan Smoleniak is a genealogist who assisted in the preparation of this article. Good morning, Megan.
Good morning.
So how difficult is it to trace genealogy in families that are descended from slaves and given the kinds of relationships that took place on plantations and the keeping of records, all sorts of challenges?
Well, when it comes to African-American genealogy, we refer to what's called the Wall of 1870. And what that refers to is the first census that was done post-emancipation. Most African-American families can march pretty steadily back to that particular point in time, but then they hit this wall in terms of getting any further in research. And sad to say, before that point, what you have to do is figure out who the owner was, because that's where any trace of your ancestors are going to be.
And then you're not talking about genealogical information. It's more trade information. It's business records, right?
Right. It's property. It's property records.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, Rachel Swarns, is the fact that, or the suspicion that Michelle Obama has a white relative three generations previous to her birth any of the New York Times business this morning?
Well, you know, I think it's very relevant, and it really resonates with people because it's so much of an American story. You know, people think a lot about her husband, the president, who is biracial, and about his background. But Michelle Obama's background is very reflective of the reality for a lot of people in terms of this older racial intermingling. So I think it really does speak to kind of who we are.
Reading this story this morning, it almost exactly reflects my own family, which if I go back to my great-great-grandmother, she was, you know, had children, about six different children by five different white guys, one of them a Scotch-Irish overseer. Clearly those relationships were not consensual in that particular case. So for many people with African-American roots going back to the slave days, genealogy is not often a fun journey back to trace our ancestors to the, you know.
It's not like my family. It goes back to the Mayflower and, you know, sort of the happy trip across the sea.
And then when you're talking about your relatives, I always say, you know, I can trace it back to my great-great-grandmother getting raped by her white overseer, and the conversation stops in the living room.
How sensitive is this, Megan Smoleniak?
Well, it's very individual to the person doing the research. It is a harsh reality, and even harder reality is the fact that those white overseers are also your ancestors. But it's a matter of whether you're willing to confront your own personal history. So everybody has to make their own choice about whether they want to go there.
Rachel Swarns, has the First Lady or the White House had any comment on your story this morning?
No. They declined to comment, saying it was a personal matter. And so they did not sit down with us for an interview.
And what would be the intent? And again, we've alluded to this. The idea is that this is a shared experience, and these genealogical records point up a story that is repeated in family after family in the United States. But journalistically, what is the intent of the New York Times in sharing this story and maybe encouraging other people to share their own stories?
I think there's just enormous interest in this historic presidency and in this family, and in having the first African-American family in the White House, and their journey there, and America's journey, what brought us here. And I think that's really where the interest lies.
Rachel Swarns is a Washington correspondent for The New York Times. Megan Smoleniak, genealogist who assisted Rachel, do you have advice for African-American families who maybe want to retrace these steps and, you know, take the possibly emotionally fraught journey back to some of these times beyond the 1870 wall?
Well, the first piece of advice I can get is talk to anybody in your family who's even 20 minutes older than you. Because the paper trail is a little bit more challenging, a lot of times family stories get passed down. I recently worked with the Haley family of Alex Haley fame, and it was because of family story that got passed down that I was able to piece together some information that otherwise would have been about impossible to find. So talk to your elders today.
Megan, I imagine some of these challenges are the same for Native American families as well. Is that true?
Yeah. You know, there's all sorts of ethnicities that have challenges. Actually, Irish is some of the toughest. There's sort of a wall of 1864 for Irish. So with every different type of heritage, you have your own set of, you know, challenges that you're going to confront. But there's almost always a way to work around them. You just have to be persistent.
It's really fascinating stuff. Megan Smoleniak is a genealogist. Rachel Swarns is a Washington correspondent for The New York Times. The story in our partner, The Times, this morning is the white relatives, the white lineage of Michelle Obama, going back 3 or 4 generations. Coming up, wouldn't it be nice to charge your cell phone without dealing with messy power cords? Liberation from power cords. It could
Sounds
be on
good.
The horizon. We talk tech every Thursday. Stay tuned for that.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headlee.
Наш советский народ не жалел сил и труда во имя победы.
So a little bit of Name That Russian this morning. That's from 1945. You know who that is, John?
He's because Joe Stalin must be, yes?
That is correct. The man
who's
most
idea.
Famously associated with the Great Purge, the Great Terror in Russia. You might think there aren't a lot of people who defend the name of Stalin. He was one of the most infamous dictators of the 20th century. But his grandson is willing to go to court to defend his grandfather's reputation. Stalin's grandson is appearing in a Moscow courtroom today to accuse a liberal Russian newspaper of defaming Stalin's reputation.
Defaming Stalin?
It's part of an ongoing story about the effort to rehabilitate the name of Joseph Stalin. We were joined earlier this morning by Rupert Wingfield Hayes. He's a Moscow correspondent for our partner, the BBC. And at the time, he'd just come back from the courtroom. We started out the conversation asking him to describe the situation at the courtroom this morning.
The court case has just kicked off within the last hour or so. And I was just outside the courthouse a few minutes ago talking to some of the pro and anti supporters there. There was a group of elderly people who are very vehement in their support of Stalin and told me what a wonderful man he was, and that his reputation has to be upheld. Equally, there were human rights workers and lawyers for the newspaper who told me that this is a real test case for freedom of speech and for Russia to be truthful about its own history.
So Stalin's grandson is suing a newspaper over something they wrote about Stalin. What did they write about him that upset him?
Well, this is quite a well-known newspaper in Moscow. It's called Novaya Gazeta, and it's probably the most prominent newspaper that likes to dig up the dirt on the current Russian leadership and Russia's past and the Soviet Union and all the sort of human rights abuses that went on. So it wrote an article condemning Stalin for contributing to starting the Second World War and also for signing, they claimed, personally signing the death warrants of thousands of people who were sent to execution and people who were sent to the Soviet gulags. And this is what his grandson has got particularly upset about. He said that while those things happened, it wasn't his grandfather who personally did it. It was bad people around him and that his grandfather is a great man.
But, Rupert, that just is so bizarre. It seems to me, no, it wasn't thousands. It was millions that he killed, actually, because the history tells a completely different story.
Absolutely. I mean, I don't think any mainstream historian either here or anywhere else doubts that Stalin was responsible for the deaths of millions of people. But there is as you said in your introduction, there is an attempt to rehabilitate the man in Russia going on, and much of it is coming out of the current Kremlin. Recently, various things have happened. For a start, books that are given to teachers in schools here to give them guidance on how to teach history, they now say that Stalin should be taught as an efficient manager who led Russia during the Second World War to defeat the Nazis. And this is a very big thing that they're trying to push here in Russia. A lot of the last century, the 20th century, was not a happy story for Russia or for the Soviet Union. But there is one great episode that they can feel proud of, and that is the defeat of Nazi Germany. And that is why I think this is it's necessary, perhaps, to rehabilitate Stalin, because he was the leader of the Soviet Union during that period.
That was Rupert Wingfield Hayes, the Moscow correspondent for our partner, the BBC, who joined us earlier this morning.
You know, if I'm not mistaken, I think Stalin was very, very nervous about his own history. He was a Georgian, born in Soviet Georgia, and
right.
I think did not emphasize his Georgian roots. And his name is actually changed from what he was.
Well, from Rupert says, they say he just got in with the wrong crowd.
Right. They told me to kill 9 million people.
Right.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headlee. Freedom's kind of a theme this morning. What about freedom from power lines and power cords? Imagine power transmission without wires. That's a tech holy grail mission. We'll talk about it in just a few minutes. We've also been talking about the Afghan war. We're beginning our 9th year in Afghanistan, marking 8 years in that war this week. Larry in Detroit emails us, after 8 years, what do we truly have to show that we have accomplished in Afghanistan, especially in respect to what we have lost in American lives? Give us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. So now let's check on some leading stories at 48 minutes after the hour. Fresh economic news out just this hour. The number of Americans filing new jobless claims is down. The number came in lower than analysts predicted. 521,000 Americans signed up for new unemployment benefits last week. Continuing claims were also down. The Congressional Budget Office has a new cost estimate for the Senate Finance Committee's health care reform bill. It puts the bill at $829 billion over a decade. That's below President Obama's cost target. The committee could vote on the bill as soon as tomorrow.
Our partner, the New York Times, reports that areas hit hard by H1N1 or swine flu last spring are not seeing a large resurgence. That's a potential sign that immunity is growing in those areas of the country. A German author born in communist Romania is the latest winner of the Nobel Prize for Literature. Herta Mueller is known for work critical of the former Romanian dictatorship. 17 are dead after a suicide bombing in Afghanistan. Dozens more were injured in the blast. It happened just outside the Indian embassy in Kabul. The Taliban claims responsibility for the attack. And looking ahead here in the U.S., the president is continuing meetings on strategy in Afghanistan. More high-level meetings are on the agenda this week. Our partner, the New York Times, says some advisors want to change the focus to al-Qaeda in neighboring Pakistan. Those are some of the news stories that we're watching this morning.
So for our Thursday tech segment, we begin with a very simple idea, a universal dream, really, voiced here by a fairly ordinary Silicon Valley techie nerd guy.
We may be able to finally get rid of those nasty little power cords that irritate us so much. We'll have to see.
Get rid of power cords? Wireless power transmission? Well, it's not just about power cords for laptops. It's been a holy grail for scientists around the world for more than a century. Whether in Russian experiments for producing home lighting without wires to Cold War-era giant transmission demonstrations by NASA conducted decades ago.
The most dramatic of these was the NASA JPL Goldstone demonstration conducted in 1975, in which 34,000 watts of power was safely transmitted over 1.5 kilometers at an efficiency of greater than 82%.
34,000 watts, ouch, that could shock you. Well, here to talk about this holy grail of wireless power on the largest and smallest scale, we're joined by Takeaway Technology contributor Farhad Manju. He writes technology stories for Slate.com. Good morning, Farhad.
Good to be here. Thank you.
And we're also joined by Eric Geiler of a company called Y-Tricity, which is developing wireless electrical technology, and he's on the line from Tokyo, Japan. Good morning to you, Eric.
Good morning, John.
So, first of all, Farhad, how important is this holy grail of wireless technology, wireless power transmission, to, first of all, just the gadget world?
Yeah, I think that if it works, if we get systems that allow you to charge your laptop, you know, wirelessly when you enter a room. It would be amazing. Right now, the system is available just on a few devices. Wireless charging, you can get it on the Palm Pre, which has a cell phone that has this adapter that you can buy for $70, and then you place the phone on this adapter, and then it charges up. And most of the current systems work like this. There's these little sort of mouse pad-like adapters, and so they don't work from very far away. But I think that if you could get a system where, you know, you could charge something from several feet away or even more, we'd all be liberated to walk around the room or go wherever we want.
We sure would. Eric Geiler, what's the science of this no-wire electrical transmission business?
The science of wireless power transfer was first presented back about 2 years ago, a little over 2 years ago at MIT, by a professor who'd been kept awake by his wife's cell phone beeping every night, running out of power. And he was thinking to himself, with all this power running around on the walls, why couldn't some of it come into his phone? The trick is, of course, you want to be able to do it safely, and you want to be able to do it efficiently. I mean, most people think of electricity, if you think of electricity going through the air, that's lightning, which inherently wouldn't be safe. What the technology that Wytricity has developed that spun out of MIT, it uses a technology called highly coupled magnetic resonance. It's a bit of a mouthful, but essentially describes a phenomena that has existed in nature, which allows two objects that are of similar resonance to be able to exchange energy with each other. And we do that using very light density magnetic fields. So that's how we get it through the air without interacting with human beings and are able to do it efficiently.
How do you make sure that this isn't kind of like turning all the lights on in your house and leaving them on, that there's not just electricity bouncing around your house all the time not being used?
Well, first of all, it isn't electricity going through the air, but what we do is, in any of these systems, they turn off if they're not being used. So they're smart enough to figure out that power isn't required at the other end.
Farhad Manju, why do these systems, which have been promised for a while, seem difficult to scale up? I mean, Sony's talking about a completely wireless flat-screen TV, but beyond that, it's pretty hard to manage these at high wattages.
Yeah, and I mean, the ones we've seen, they've raised a lot of expectations, but they fail kind of in the implementation. So, for example, there's this Dell laptop, the Latitude Z, which, you know, made a lot of news because it was going to get wireless power, which is something that lots of people want in a laptop. But it turns out that in order for it to work, it comes with this huge stand, this huge sort of charging stand. And instead of plugging the laptop into the wall, you have to just put the laptop on the stand, and it's kind of an ugly stand. And it's also $200. So people weren't big fans of that. I mean, I think that if they can sort of perfect that portion of it, it might work. Although you have to also consider that it might also cost a lot.
So. Right. I mean, there's a safety question if you get the voltages up really, really high. Eric Geiler, does the technology that NASA demonstrated back in the 70s of power transmission have anything to do with the kind of work that you're doing on smaller gadgets?
Actually not. Most of the technology that was developed previously for running power over distance did what's called radiated. And when it radiates, you don't want to be getting in the way of it.
Yeah.
The technology we're using actually scales from quite small devices to quite large ones. So I'm actually over in Japan this week, where I'm presenting the keynote at an electronics conference where we're demonstrating the ability to charge an electric car when you pull it into your garage.
Wow.
So you drive in, there's a mat plugged into the floor, basically. The coil that's built into the mat essentially couples to one that's underneath the vehicle so people don't get anywhere near it, and it transfers actually about 3,000 watts so that overnight your car will charge. So think of all these new electric cars coming onto the market. You won't even have to plug them in.
Well, Farhad, how exciting does that sound to you? I know you're pretty much of a skeptic of these things scaled up beyond the laptop.
I mean, if it works, I would be – that sounds great. You know, I'm a skeptic just because of the kinds of gadgets we've seen so far haven't been great. But I would be the first one to get a laptop that charges wirelessly in a room that I enter. I mean, I think that would be magical.
Farhad, you know, I it's really difficult for me to break away from a tech segment this week without asking you about the new Windows cell phone. Without having seen this myself, is this going to cause as much buzz as the iPhone did?
No. In a word, no. I mean, the problem with the Windows cell phone is it's actually just an update. And from what I've read, I haven't tried it either, but from reviews I've read, it's a very poor and almost incomplete update of the operating system that Microsoft has released for mobile phones for a long time, for many years. And they've made some aesthetic changes. They've changed the interface a little bit. But from what I've read, if you dig down deep into the phone and try the various menus and everything, some parts of it don't work, and some parts of it work as well as the phone did, you know, back 4 years ago.
Oh, no raves there from Farhad Manju, who writes on technology news for Slate.com. Thanks to both you and Eric Geiler, CEO of Y-Tricity, a company that is developing wireless electricity technology. Thanks, guys.
If you want more details about that or anything else, you can take our podcast to go. Subscribe now at thetakeaway.org. You can also sign up for our Twitter feed while you're there. We got a few tweets about how people are excited about cooking with pumpkins after yesterday's talk about what else you can do with them other than pies. Recipes there for roasted pumpkin stuffed with bread and Gruyere cheese, pumpkin cheesecake with amaretto sour cream topping, Old English apple pumpkin pie. It's all on thetakeaway.org. We've also been talking this week about the war in Afghanistan since it began 8 years ago. Have your thoughts changed about the war, and where should we be a year from now? What's more, what's the mission in Afghanistan? 8778-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
We just got this email. We were talking earlier about how Microsoft can't get a break from the tech review world. I was actually being sympathetic to Microsoft, but you said poor Microsoft after your Farhad didn't give a good review to the latest Windows phone. John, you sound like a smart and impartial journalist, but not this time. Granted, some Microsoft products aren't perfect, but since bashing Microsoft is a sport and you didn't stop, I think you're a toady to perhaps Apple and Linux followers. No, actually, I'm not. I will disclose I am a Mac user, but I have a Windows machine as well. But I think it's true. I'm a PC user.
Microsoft can't get a break. I think people pick on Microsoft.
You're right.
I was trying to say that. Not that I feel bad for Microsoft.
But you can criticize me. I don't care. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Celeste Headlee. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
Note to the United Nations. Excuse us, but we have a question.
What do that mean?
The United Nations prepares to renew the mandate permitting NATO and U.S. forces in Afghanistan under international law. Does it clarify a mission, muddy the waters, or just give a green light to the generals? Knowing what the UN means, good luck. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. Thursday, October 8th. I'm John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headlee.
Good morning, John. Have you heard of Herta Mueller? I hope you
have. Not till this morning.
Yeah, she's the new Nobel Prize winner for literature. That conversation is going to continue online at thetakeaway.org. Absolutely. Plus, we've all had parents or grandparents who walked uphill both ways to school 10 miles with no shoes. But
we have?
Well, I did. We have today, barely any kids walked to school, bad weather or not. And it's actually a problem. We're going to talk about that.
But first, let's talk to Evelyn Farka, senior fellow with the American Security Project. She just returned from Afghanistan this week. So Evelyn, does the United Nations mandate, which is about to be renewed for troops in Afghanistan, does it explicitly rule out an occupation of the country?
Not necessarily. And of course, militarily, we've occupied much of the country. But I would say that our interest is actually in establishing and supporting good government in Afghanistan and eventually leaving.
Well, what does it mean? We're going to explore the fine print in the UN mandate with Evelyn Farkas and some others. Stay with us. We'll be back with you in just a moment. Right now, everything else you need to know this morning.
In the headlines, new jobless claims numbers just out last hour. They dropped to 521,000 last week. That's the lowest level since January. The number is better than analysts expected. Still a lot of people out of work, though. $829 billion over 10 years. That's the congressional Budget Office's price estimate for the Senate Finance Committee's health care bill. It's below President Obama's cost target. The committee could vote on the bill as soon as tomorrow.
Back to Afghanistan, where at least 17 are dead and dozens more injured after a car bombing. The Taliban claims responsibility for a blast outside the Indian embassy in Kabul. New violence comes as President Obama considers a request for more forces in Afghanistan. Our partner, the New York Times, reports this morning that some advisors may want to change focus to al-Qaeda in Pakistan. That news comes after a high-level strategy meeting yesterday. And as we've mentioned, a German author born in communist Romania is the newest winner of the Nobel Prize for Literature. Herta Mueller is known for her depiction of harsh conditions in Romania. Her latest novel is set in Romania in 1945. Wall Street gained a little bit, but it was basically flat yesterday. The Dow opens at 97.26. The S&P starts trading at 10.58. And the NASDAQ begins at 21.10. And futures trading suggest a marginally positive opening when Wall Street gets underway about 30 minutes from now. We've been marking the eighth year America has been fighting in Afghanistan. Should there be a next year? What is the mission? We're going to explore the nature of the United Nations mandate, which permits U.S. forces in Afghanistan. But why don't you clarify the situation for us? What do you think the mission is in Afghanistan? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or tell us your story of this, which could turn out to be America's longest war. My take at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. Well, more disturbing news out of Afghanistan this morning. A powerful car bomb attack targeted the Indian embassy in Kabul. The BBC is reporting that at least 17 are dead and at least 60 people injured, including members of Afghan security forces. The BBC's Martin Patience was on the scene. Listen carefully, because he's on a cell phone from the Indian embassy.
According to one eyewitness, there's a five-foot crater in the road, and most of the casualties appear to have been bystanders caught in the blast when it went off. I've just seen one man drive his car from the scene with its windscreen blown out, and I've just spoken with one policeman who said that there's blood and shreds of children's clothing lying in the road.
The BBC's Martin Patience in Kabul. The Taliban have claimed responsibility for that attack. We'll continue to follow it all morning.
So all week long, we've been following the mission in the Afghan war, marking really the beginning of the ninth year of the U.S. presence in Afghanistan. What is the mission? Well, it's something that the Obama administration is considering. Can we clarify the mission at this point? We want to hear from you on that subject. 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org. Today, the United Nations Security Council is expected to renew the mandate for ISAF, that's the NATO-led International Security Assistance Force in Afghanistan. And that mandate is one of the documents that sets out the mission of what the troops are supposed to be doing in Afghanistan. We thought we would look at this mandate and see if there is any clarity or lack of clarity to try to decipher what the mission is, as the Obama administration is doing, as other nations are doing, to try to figure out what the strategy is in Afghanistan and what going forward the goal ought to be. To talk about this, we spoke with Evelyn Farkas, senior fellow with the American Security Project. She was part of a NATO delegation just returned from Afghanistan this week. We also spoke with Nick Childs at Bush House in London. Nick is a defense and security correspondent for our partners, the BBC's, and he told us how the UN's mandate is being viewed overseas.
Well, it's interesting that actually in the debate that is here going on almost as with as much anguish as it is in Washington, I think, what the precise mandate the UN is proposing really hasn't been part of the discussion. I think the assumption was that it would get renewed, but there is a lack of clarity here, people say, on what British troops, what Western troops there should be doing. And there is this sense of what is the mission now. People are asking why the troops are still there. The British government's view of it is very much similar, I think, to the Obama administration's, that this is fundamentally a sort of hard-nosed British national security self-interest, that they're there to protect against the spread of terrorism, the spread of militants, influence onto the streets of Britain, essentially, and that they don't want Afghanistan to become an incubator for that again in the future. Whether people here are buying that or are listening to that lesson is unclear.
Well, Evelyn Farkas, you get a sense from Nick Childs there of the political sensitivities inside Britain in terms of what the mission is going forward in Afghanistan. We have similar sort of political considerations here in the United States. We're going to talk in a moment to a correspondent in Berlin, Germany, where Germany is also debating this. Evelyn Farkas, does the United Nations have any responsibility to clarify the mission in a mandate like this, or is it mere, sort of window dressing?
Yeah, John, I think it's a good question, but quite frankly, you know, they usually give broad mandates. I mean, essentially, if they're authorizing the use of force, it's usually not very specific, and they leave it up to the member states to negotiate how the actual operation will unfold, militarily speaking.
Yet, aren't there specifics? I mean, if you're to distinguish the mandate for ISAF and the mandate in Iraq, I mean, one would say that Iraq is specifically an occupation, whereas the Afghanistan mandate is something quite different. How do you distinguish them?
Well, I mean, the mandate in Afghanistan does clearly make a nod to the sovereignty of Afghanistan. But at the same time, it says that the situation is a threat to international peace and security. So I'm not sure that it's that different from the mandate in Iraq, to be honest. But I think that we are interpreting it differently, and we are trying very hard to set up a government in Afghanistan that is, you know, somewhat viable and legitimate so that we can actually transition out of there sooner rather than later.
And we should note there are 68,000 U.S. forces and a contingent of British forces in Afghanistan, also forces from the nation of Germany, where Tristana Moore, a BBC Berlin correspondent, joins us now to talk about what is the debate in Germany over its contribution to the ISAF force. Tristana?
Well, yeah, that's a very good question. I mean, this was a big debate in the run-up to the election, and Chancellor Merkel won that election 10 days ago. She's just forming now this new centre-right government, and it's going to be interesting to see what the new government's position on the Afghan mission is. I mean, basically, Chancellor Merkel has to stick to the current mandate because Germany's Afghan mission is governed by this parliamentary mandate that limits troops to peacekeeping and reconstruction efforts in the relatively peaceful north of Afghanistan. But the Afghan mission is deeply unpopular here in Germany, and that mission has come under fire from opposition politicians. The ex-communist Left Party during the election campaign was the only party which called for a troop pullout, and I think Chancellor Merkel will come under increasing pressure to bring troops back home.
But in Germany, was this parliamentary mandate, did it distinct say that there couldn't be an increase in troops that Germany sends?
Yeah, I mean, it's stuck to this limit. At the moment, there are 4,200 German troops in Afghanistan, and this mission is governed by this parliamentary mandate, which limits the troops to essentially peacekeeping and reconstruction efforts. But of course, you know, increasingly, German forces have come under attack, now virtually under daily attack. And many commentators here are calling this a war, which the politicians and Chancellor Merkel have been reluctant to call it a war. They insist always this is a humanitarian mission focused on reconstruction. But basically, I mean, you have to go back to German history, really, and the legacy of Germany's Nazi past has led to these military limits being written into the country's constitution. So up until now, according to the German constitution, the role of Germany's armed forces has been strictly defensive, which is why there is always this big debate here.
So in a certain sense, because of Germany's special history, it has a special sort of political sensitivity here. Nick Childs, defense and security correspondent for the BBC in London. I'm surprised, quite frankly, Nick, by how vulnerable the international coalition about maintaining a presence in Afghanistan seems to be, when for years there was all of this anxiety about the commitment to Iraq, but it seemed that the commitment to Afghanistan, the mission was pretty clear.
Well, I think it is precisely because 8 years on, people are wondering, A, what's been achieved, and B, where we go from here, essentially. And it has been very much focused on in recent times, as I think it is in the has been in the States as well, because there's been suddenly this increase in casualty numbers. And frankly, it is worrying and it is causing concern amongst the British population. And there has been a very specific debate here, which has put the government very much on the defensive, and Gordon Brown personally, the Prime Minister personally, because there has been a lot of allegations that the troop numbers haven't been what were requested by the military, the equipment hasn't been the same. The government denies this, but it's put the government very much back on the defensive, and the sense of the British people may be prepared to support our boys, as it were, if the mission was clear, but they're much more concerned about, you know, whether the government has got the strategy right, whether Afghanistan is the right focus or whether it should be on Pakistan.
Indeed, and as the casualties rise, it's the Taliban that has the initiative here implicitly, as Germany is on the defensive, Britain is on the defensive, in some sense the Obama administration, if not on the defensive, is certainly trying to figure out what its policy is. Evelyn Farkas, let's go back to you before we end the segment here. Is there anything in the UN mandate, anything about the specificity of the UN mandate that would tend to prolong the NATO presence there, that would tend to say that you're really supposed to stay there until things are politically stable for the people of Afghanistan? Anything like that?
That's a very good question, John. Again, I think it's, you know, it's a document that's pretty broad and you can interpret it either way. But certainly it does lay out, I mean, it has all kinds of references to women's rights, references to freedom of movement, all kinds of, you know, environmental qualities or contingencies that are clearly not in place right now. But if I could just jump off of something that Nick said, you know, I think one of the issues is that the Taliban, what I heard from the commanders on the ground when I was there last week, is that the Taliban in the winter, they used to kind of go to ground, if you will. I mean, they are people too. They get cold. It's harder to, you know, operate and make plans. But what we've seen recently, or at least the commanders have seen, is that the Taliban has been more active in the winter.
Wow.
And so they came out really strong this spring and summer, and they started to cause a lot of trouble for ISAF forces all over Afghanistan.
Well, there's an interesting takeaway in Afghanistan that the Taliban has a higher profile in winter, and that's not something that ISAF, the forces in Afghanistan, have been used to. That's Evelyn Farkas, senior fellow with the American Security Project, just back from Afghanistan. Nick Childs is defense and security correspondent for our partners, the BBC, and Tristana Moore is the BBC Berlin correspondent. We spoke with all of them earlier this morning.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Hey, you want that to go?
Now some quick takeouts on stories we're following all this week. We're going to go first to Todd Zwillick, the Takeaway's Washington correspondent. Well, Todd, this has to be good news for the Democrats. The Congressional Budget Office says not only does this bill cost less than President Obama's target of $900 billion, but it could reduce the deficit, right?
Yeah, that's exactly what it says. You know, I was thinking about this morning. Ibrahim always gets to do the scores. Now I get to do one finally, but it's a CBO score, unfortunately. But in my little world, this is a big one. This is a CBO score on the Finance Committee bill.
Acronym alert.
Congressional Budget Office.
Thank you.
Which is a wonky institution, but boy, oh boy, are they important in Washington. They are the official arbiters of how much all legislation costs for the deficit and for taxpayers. So the score on the Finance Committee healthcare bill, the one we've been talking about for weeks, the Baucus bill, is $829 billion over 10 years. And while that is a lot of money, you said it, Celeste, the president said $900 billion or less, so they're well under that. Not only that, the CBO says that after 10 years, this bill will save the taxpayers $81 billion. So that's huge. This is the news that Democrats were waiting for to be able to sell their plan on the Hill and in Washington. Here's Max Baucus, chairman of the Finance Committee.
This is very good news. I'm very pleased. Today, the Congressional Budget Office confirmed that the legislation of the Finance Committee to reform our health care system remains fully paid for and reduces the federal deficit. That's good news.
Now, how many people will this cover? Right now, 83% of Americans have insurance. CBO says once this bill is fully enacted, that'll go up to 94% of legal residents. Now, this leaves out illegal people, illegal immigrants, or anyone else who's undocumented. Of course, keep in mind, if we don't cover them now, we're still going to have to pay for them if they go to the hospital. It also
leaves out the public option.
Well, it does. And it's very interesting. The CBO was silent on the public option because as of now, as we know, it's not in this Finance Committee bill. It has a co-op. We've been talking about that. And the CBO took a pretty dim view of the co-op. It said they see no cost savings involved in the co-op. They say they see no reason why co-ops would be competitive in any of the existing insurance markets across the country. So for those Democrats out there who don't like the co-op idea and want what they call, you know, a robust public option or the real public option, the fine print of the CBO report is good news for them too. When the public option debate comes up in the coming weeks in the House and in the Senate, they're going to have ammunition. That's what this gives them.
Okay, Todd Zwillick, Takeaways Washington correspondent.
So let's get down to business with Louise Story, finance reporter for our partners at the New York Times. The takeout this morning involves writers. Now, writers are used to being on deadline, right?
Right.
But there's suddenly a deadline of November 9th in this landmark copyright case that involves Google's mission to establish a more or less complete digital archive of all published text. It's a copyright case, it's a business case, and it's about writers getting paid. What's going on?
So the Department of Justice came in a month ago and objected to a settlement that Google had worked out with the Authors Guild. And the reason they objected is that they're afraid that Google could become more of a monopoly. They're also afraid that this settlement is locking in prices, so we won't have price competition for books.
So the settlement itself would create disturbing precedents that the Department of Justice doesn't really want to have
possibly
happen.
So they're having to renegotiate. But I mean, the bigger picture here is that here we've got Google moving into books. You know, this has already happened in music. You know, we've already had the Napsterization of music. It's already happened in the media. Everything's going online. This is the way of the future. We have something that we say in the media. It's that Google is the frenemy.
The frenemy.
It's part friend. Yeah, the frenemy. It's part friend, part enemy. And the reason they're the, yeah.
Well, what Google would say to that is that unlike Napster,
yep,
you can't download books wholly from the Google archive. You can look at selections from them. And so they say that that gives them immunity from this idea that we're just sort of giving away books for free.
That's a solid point. There are other people who feel it's not that different. But the reason they're the friend, of course, is that it's really great if you can just search the text of books. And they're also making audio versions of books that could help blind people. You can print, you know, that's a really great
something
thing.
The Library of Congress used to do, which is why librarians are also concerned about this, that this actually competes, encroaches on
right?
the library's
why
traditional
Why go to the
role?
Library if you can go online? So, you know, for writers, I mean, I'm a writer. Maybe I'll write a book sometime. I like the idea that more and more books can be online, but you want to make sure that people get compensated for what they write.
Now, authors say that even though you can't get my book for free, the validity and the credibility of the Google archive depends on their intellectual property
yep.
being there. And so the payment is not for free books. The payment is for, you know, it's not just random text from the telephone book you have in your archive,
right.
Google. This is a legacy of civilization itself.
That's right. I mean, books, more than anything, become the history of what happened. They're more thorough than anything we can do in real time in daily journalism. They go back, they check things, and so it's really important that the right ones, you know, all get on there so that it's a complete archive.
Right. Last question. You're a finance reporter for the New York Times. Is there a dollar value at all to this Google archive? Will the Supreme Court ever rule on that, do you think?
Well, you know, the settlement has been for $125 million. I mean, they're going back
seems
to
read. So cheap.
Renegotiate, you know,
how much
what are books worth?
How much would the Library of Alexandria be worth if we could sell it today on eBay? Thank you, Louise Story.
Thank you. Our last takeout comes from you, the listeners. It's the 8-year anniversary of the war in Afghanistan, and we've been tracking it through your stories.
Rob in Detroit, Michigan, bringing the troops home, bringing the troops home. They're tired. They're worn out. We should have not been over there in the first place.
Keep the stories coming. Do you have a family member in the war, and what are the signs of war in your home? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. We'll take a listen to more of them tomorrow.
We've been talking about health care, and some of you listeners are claiming we're not talking about the right issues.
One thing that really disturbs me is that there's not been an open discussion of all the features of House Bill 676, which is a single payer. I think you owe it to the public to talk about that bill so they at least know what it is.
So we asked Todd Zwillick, what does he say about that, our Takeaway Washington correspondent? He says H.R. 676 is a single-payer health care bill, similar versions of which have been introduced by Congressman John Conyers of Michigan for many years. That bill would establish free government-sponsored health care for all Americans. The plan is financed by tax increases on the wealthiest 5% of Americans.
But another listener, John from Irvington, New York, says we're missing the debate completely.
I think it's a little weird that we're talking about universal insurance rather than universal health care. I think we're creating a system that's complicated and expensive simply to satisfy the special interests in Washington.
Well, that raised what we talked about earlier this morning. Is it a right? No, we're just talking about money here. Why isn't the debate more about rights?
It's not just greed of the corporations. It's greed of the people. And then it's also jealousy. Maybe if people understood that it would be okay if educated people made more money, just like the corporations, it would be a better society.
You can reach us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. And if you go on the website, you can see a robust debate that Ibrahim always starts with his sports analysis.
He does.
Ibrahim
Abdul-Mateen,
Takeaway sports contributor, and gets a lot of response from you. Keep it coming.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at GatesFoundation.org and by the Freeman Foundation. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, it turns out if you're facing foreclosure, a lawyer could actually help you save your home. Problem is, there aren't enough lawyers to go around. We're going to talk about that in a minute. But first, here are some of the news stories we're following at 32 minutes after the hour. New unemployment claims are down. Numbers just out last hour show 521,000 Americans filed jobless claims last week. That's the lowest level since January. Meanwhile, there's news the federal deficit tripled in the past year. It hit a record $1.4 trillion.
Markets are rallying on the news for whatever reason. The Dow and the S&P are both up about a half a percentage point. Here's another big number from D.C., $829 billion over the next 10 years. That's the Congressional Budget Office's price estimate for the Senate Finance Committee's health care reform bill. The committee could vote as soon as tomorrow. German author Herta Mueller has won the Nobel Prize in Literature. She was born in communist Romania, where her early work was censored, had to be smuggled out of the country. In Afghanistan, at least 17 are dead after a Taliban suicide bombing outside the Indian embassy in Kabul. The Taliban took responsibility for it. And the violence comes as President Obama considers sending more troops to Afghanistan. Our partner, the New York Times, reports some national security advisors are considering shifting the focus to Al-Qaeda in neighboring Pakistan. In sports, baseball, first-round playoff action yesterday. L.A. Dodgers beat St. Louis. The defending Philadelphia Phillies stomped Colorado, and the Yankees topped Minnesota. Boston and the L.A. Angels start their series later tonight. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
So the number of foreclosures, especially among lower-income people, has been going up. That's not news. But what's happening at the same time is there's also a national shortage of legal aid attorneys to represent people through foreclosures. And for many people, the issue of foreclosure, losing your home, what could be more personal?
This has been my home for almost 40 years. This is the only place I know. It's fallen down, but this is all I got.
That's the voice of Virginia Frazier. She's a blind widow of a veteran. She's facing foreclosure because of a drastically reduced income in the wake of her husband's death. She has no idea what she's going to do, and I imagine she can't get an attorney to represent her as she's going through foreclosure, and that's a big problem. We're joined today by Milanka Clark, an attorney for the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University Law School. Milanka, you published a report on Wednesday called Foreclosures, A Crisis in Legal Representation. Tell me what this study found.
Sure. Good morning, Celeste. So just as you said, the staggering dimensions of the foreclosure crisis itself are very well known, but less well documented, and as shown in our report, the vast majority of homeowners who are facing foreclosure are doing so without legal help. So our report found, in the jurisdictions that we looked at, for instance, that in Connecticut, over 60% of homeowners of defendants in foreclosure proceedings didn't have a lawyer. Stark County, Ohio, that number was 86%.
Wow.
And here in New York, in some of the hardest hit impacted counties, and here we were actually able to isolate and just look at those homeowners that had subprime and high cost loans, those figures were as high as 80% and 90%. And you think about the fact that, you know, the foreclosure number is projected to get to 8 million by 2012. You multiply that by the numbers we have, and you can see the dimensions of the problem.
We're also joined by Sarah Bowling. She's a staff attorney with Atlanta Legal Aid's Home Defense Program. Sarah, good morning. Does a lawyer really make that big of a difference? I mean, if somebody can't afford their mortgage and they're going into foreclosure, how is a lawyer going to help them?
Good morning, Celeste. Having a lawyer absolutely makes a huge difference in the foreclosure process, and that's true in both judicial foreclosure and non-judicial foreclosure states. Lawyers can identify legal violations from the origination of the loan and raise those claims for leverage to be able to seek a loan modification for that homeowner. And they can also stop the foreclosure process through either filing a lawsuit and getting an injunction or going into a bankruptcy, taking the homeowner into a bankruptcy. There are a number of different options that a lawyer brings that someone without a lawyer just doesn't have.
So take a listen to the comments from these two listeners.
Yeah, my name's Todd. I'm from Connecticut. Basically, we lost our house. So this subprime thing that happened has hit us, my family. And I guess I'd just like to say, I wonder when, you know, this country's going to bail out the typical family.
I'm terrified. I don't sleep at night. I'm scared for my grandkids. I mean, I just, you know, what are we looking at? And I'm not going to be the only one in this situation, I understand. And I feel sorry for the ones who are worse off than I, but it's terrifying.
So, Sarah, you have to turn away people from your office. You don't have enough attorneys to represent them. Why are you turning people away?
It is absolutely a lack of resources. And we have four lawyers and one half-time lawyer in our office. We actually did get funding to hire an Equal Justice Works AmeriCorps fellow. So we are going to be getting one more lawyer, which we're very excited about. But we still will be turning people away. And these will be people who are income eligible for our services and who may have legal claims. But we just cannot meet the need. Hmm. The numbers are so staggering.
Well, Sarah Bowling there describes that there's a resource question, but Malanka Clark from the Brennan Center at NYU, is it also possible that people just don't ask for legal representation, that they feel because of guilt or just some sort of sense that I blew it myself, who can possibly help me, that they're foregoing legal representation that they're actually entitled to?
Sure. There is, you know, certainly some people get the default notice and just want to bury their heads in the sand. But part of the problem is a lack of awareness about what some of the options are and a lack of awareness of where they can go for help, because help is not readily available for everybody. And I would just add that, you know, all of this needs to be understood about against the backdrop of the fact that by some estimates, 80% of the legal needs of the poor have gone unmet. And so the foreclosure crisis, it didn't cause the shortage of lawyers for poor people, but it certainly has greatly intensified the demand.
What about, there's a lot of people who are middle class who are going through foreclosure and probably can't afford a lawyer also, but they're not going to meet the income restrictions for legal aid. What about those folks?
That's a problem, too. And what some states have done and increasingly are doing are thinking of other types of interventions for folks. So, for instance, here in New York, for example, there are mediation programs that have become available, at least for some sets of homeowners. That, you know, it depends on the nature of the program, how helpful that can be, but that is something that has been provided. Also, housing counselors is another option for some homeowners that are finding trouble. They can't find a lawyer. They're exactly, as you said, somewhere in between. They can at least talk to a counselor to help them at least make a plan around their budget. The problem is that if you have a viable legal claim, these type of interventions are not going to be able to help you vindicate your rights in court, and that's a problem.
So, Sarah Bowling with Atlanta Legal Aid, I can't imagine that sending out a few million dollars to the legal aid offices across the nation is high in the priority list of the Congress this week, at least. So what are our options to solve this problem?
Well, there are other options, and I think this is covered in the report, that the possibility of changing some of the LSC, the Legal Services Corporation, restrictions on funding could actually help solve the problem without costing taxpayers money. For instance, legal aid lawyers right now are not allowed to ask for attorney's fees in the cases that we file. And in the consumer law arena, most laws, such as the Truth in Lending Act and other and Unfair and Deceptive Practices Act, most of the laws that we use allow attorneys to seek attorney's fees from the other side if they prevail. But we're not allowed to ask for attorney's fees because of those rules that have been in place.
So it could be no cost to fix the problem. Sarah Bowling with Atlanta Legal Aid. Also Malanka Clark, an attorney at the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University Law School. Thanks to both of you.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Hockenberry. Well, I knew it would happen, okay? This morning in Stockholm, the Nobel Prize Committee announced that Romanian-born German writer Herta Mueller has won the Nobel Prize.
You knew that would happen.
Well, I knew that I'd eventually have to read Atomschauker, which is her latest novel. Everything I possess, I carry with me. She's also the writer of The Passport and The Land of Green Plums. And yes, this is the first time I've ever heard of Herta Mueller, which just shows you how ignorant I am. But the Nobel Prize Committee, the Swedish Academy, described her with a concentration of poetry and frankness of prose. She depicts the landscape of the dispossessed. She gets a $1.4 million prize. Here to talk about it is Patrick Henry Bass, book editor of Essence magazine and our contributor. So they overlooked a lot of folks to get to Herta Mueller, and we should congratulate her, of course.
We should, absolutely. That wacky Nobel board. Everyone was the odds-on money was for Amos Oz.
Right, the Israeli writer. The
Israeli writer, you know, who has an amazing memoir, Tale of Love and Darkness. And then the dark horse, the Susan Lucci and Randy Newman of the Nobel for Literature, Joyce Carol Oates, and Philip Roth, you know, who were both robbed. You know,
you think they were robbed? Well, American hasn't won since Toni Morrison,
well,
right?
Well, this is, Celeste and John, this is the crazy thing about the winner this year. The latest judge said that he wanted the Nobel Prizes to be less Eurocentric. And what do? They go with the German woman, you know. And I think it's about playing fair.
Well, but isn't there something about the Swedish Academy's invitation to discover a writer that's new that is valid in your view?
Well, not really.
Not new, but someone who you might not someone who might have been overlooked.
Well, Bob Dylan was also in contention for the award. And what I'm thinking is perhaps Bob Dylan split the vote between Joyce Carol Oates and possibly Philip Roth. But there was also Cormac McCarthy, who was also ran. There was Thomas Pynchon, who's done an amazing book, Inherent Vice, this year. Dr. Maya Angelou, who TMZ had pronounced was ill, so people were looking at her favorability. It's going up because people thought, hey, you know, Dr. Angelou, 80 years old, this may be the time to give it to her. Still no award. And Adonis, who's an amazing Syrian poet. There had been some controversy about whether or not poets were going to get the Nobel Prize. It's been since 1990 since a poet has won. So the odds on favor, if it wasn't going to be Mueller, who really is truly a come from behind winner, it was going to be Adonis, who's a Syrian poet.
Does the Nobel Prize for Literature sell books, in your view?
It doesn't sell books, but what it does do, it can resuscitate a career. It keeps your books in print forever. You will always have the seal. You'll always have that medal. You'll also have the memories of that amazing ceremony, you know, that probably two people in the world watch.
You're sounding a little bitter.
You're also going to end up on a lot of college course curriculum guides.
No, but you're one of 100 authors in the world who, you know, have this distinguished honor.
And we should note that there are some famous authors, some extraordinary writers who never got the Nobel. Nabokov was one.
Proust.
And many others.
Exactly. Now, one of the things that we should also know is that the Nobel Prize resuscitated careers like William Faulkner. Right. William Faulkner's books were out of print.
Indeed.
Until he won Nobel Prize in 1949.
So we want to remind people, Herta Mueller, a German writer who was born in Romania, has won the Nobel Prize for Literature, and that was just announced this morning by the Swedish Academy. Her prize for that is a $1.4 million prize. It's probably good because, as you say, it doesn't sell
the
much.
And a ticket to Oslo.
Yeah. Patrick Henry Bass, books editor of Essence magazine and Takeaway contributor. Thanks.
Thank you.
Good morning. I'm Celeste Headley here with John Hockenberry. Coming up, how far did you walk to school when you were growing up? Well, if you're a kid today, you probably don't walk at all. More about how kids are walking less and less to school and why that's a problem. But first, let's check on the leading stories at 47 minutes after the hour. The number of people applying for new unemployment benefits is down to 521,000 last week. Those are better numbers than analysts predicted. Our partner, the New York Times, reports that some places hit hard by H1N1 or swine flu in the spring aren't suffering a big resurgence in cases. That could be a sign that people's immunity is growing.
A German author born in communist Romania is the newest winner of the Nobel Prize in Literature. Herta Mueller's early work was censored by Romanian authorities. It was smuggled out for publication. In the huge sigh of relief department, here's an interesting story we found. If you fear a large asteroid hitting Earth, NASA now says you can breathe easier. There's a 1 in 250,000 chance an asteroid will hit us in 2036. But the original odds were much worse. 1 in 45,000. Looking ahead, the Senate Finance Committee could vote on its health care bill as early as tomorrow. The cost of the plan comes in at $829 billion. That's under the sort of limit Barack Obama set, and the number is from the Congressional Budget Office. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Well, I did a lot of walking when I was growing up. It was a couple miles from my house to my high school, and there was never an argument in my home. My mom told us to get up, get out of the house, walk to school, and we never said, Mom, could you drive us instead? My legs hurt. I'm tired. But the fact of the matter is, when I was born in 1969, nearly 50% of kids walked to school.
When I was a kid back in the 60s.
Hey, I'm younger than you, Buster. Yeah, right. But today, that number's dropped to 13%.
Wow.
So let's check in now with an actual kid, Berkeley Anderson. She's 13. She's walking to school right now in Highland, Utah. Good morning, Berkeley.
Hey.
First of all, you're not all that concerned about getting to school on time, right?
No.
Doesn't your school start? You walk 2 miles to school every day.
Yeah.
Would you rather have your mom drive you?
Sometimes.
Sometimes? How bad does the weather have to be for your mom to put you in the car?
Usually when it's snowing and really cold.
Really, really cold.
What do you see along your route? What do you see along your route, Berkeley?
Well, I walk through neighborhoods, so I see a lot of houses, and then I pass by an elementary school on my way, so then there's a lot of kids and parents driving their kids to school there.
Lots of parents dropping their kids off. Do you have to avoid their cars as they're heading in towards the school?
Yeah, there's sidewalks, too, but then we have to, like, cross roads and stuff.
But it doesn't worry you. When did you start walking to school? How young were you?
Probably in, like, second grade, maybe first.
So, Berkeley Anderson, you are a better person because you walk to school every day. Why?
Well, it makes me stay more in shape, and I just like getting the fresh air and stuff.
The fresh air in Highland, Utah. That's Berkeley Anderson, who's probably going to be late to school, and it doesn't really bother her. Someone just honked at Berkeley
Anderson.
She's
out in the middle of the road. Berkeley, look out!
If you're one of our listeners honking at Berkeley Anderson, cut that out. Thanks very much, Berkeley. Have a good day at school. We talked to someone else who's also walking to school. I guess we found some of the rare kids. But Jeremiah Weintraub, a 10-year-old, walking to school in Charleston, West Virginia. We spoke to him. He's actually probably in class now.
Right.
But we talked to him earlier about how long it takes him to get to school in the morning.
About 5 minutes.
Wouldn't you rather get in the car and ride with your mom or dad?
No.
Why not?
Because it sort of just gives you a jump start on the day.
So when did you, how young were you when you started walking to school?
About 7.
And were you scared?
Not really.
Why not?
Because I'd been out before, but I just really hadn't been walking to school, so.
Okay, so what? Tell me how you would convince your friend who rides in his car with his mom every morning. What do you say to your friend to get him out of his mom's car and walking to school?
I normally say it's a lot more fun, and it, like, wakes you up in the morning. It makes you more alert and ready to learn.
Okay, that's Jeremiah Weintraub walking to school today in Charleston, West Virginia. It is National Walk to School Month.
I did not know that.
It is. And you might be wondering, why do we need a National Walk to School Month? Well, to explain that, we have with us Gina Lovasi. She's the Associate Director of the Health and Society Scholars Program at Columbia University's Mailman School of Public Health, and also our own takeaway correspondent, Andrea Bernstein. So, Gina, let's go to you first. How big a problem is, I mean, we're kind of joking, taking it kind of lightly, but I understand this is actually a relatively serious problem.
Right. Well, I think we need to consider the potential for getting physical activity as part of kids' daily lives. There's a lot of fear about what might happen to kids while they're walking to school, but we know that traffic hazards...
They might get abducted right.
Right, but violent crime and traffic hazards have decreased or remained stable over the last couple of decades, while obesity rates among children in the U.S. have tripled.
Well, there's a conference going on in New York City right now. It is the Walk 21 NYC conference that started yesterday in New York. Here's Rodney Tolley, the conference director.
We now know that it's actually the most dangerous thing you can do to a child. Putting a child in the front seat of a car and driving that child to school, you expose the child to the highest level of pollution imaginable. And, of course, by taking them away from their friends and from interaction with their community and their neighborhood, you're damaging their mental health long term. You're damaging their physical health because kids who aren't walkers as kids don't become walkers as adults. It's the worst imaginable thing to do.
Holy cow, Andrea Bernstein, you were at that conference.
Worst
imaginable thing?
Well, it has pretty bad and pretty long-term effects. And, you know, one of the things that sort of really hit me last night or yesterday at the conference and all the different workshops that I was going to was just how much American society is built to make it hard for anybody to walk, let alone a child. We, you know, people live very far from their work. Schools are built on the outskirts of society. They're built out on, you know, big roads. Many of them have no sidewalks, but they do have parking lots. So there's actually an inducement for people to drive and not to walk.
So, Gina Lavasi with the Health and Society Scholars Program at Columbia University, the other thing that hit me as I was reading this is actually traffic accidents are the leading cause of death among young people. So maybe people don't realize that by putting their kid in the car, they are less safe.
Yes, I think that's right. I think we need to put the risks in proportion to each other, and it's much more likely to be killed or injured in an accident as a passenger in a car or to be injured by the long-term effects of obesity.
But what do you say to people who listen to you and say, oh, well, fine, in the city, you can walk to school. I live in Westchester County, or I live in the suburbs of Detroit, or I'm out in Los Angeles where, you know, walking is a social disease. I mean, how practical is this for people outside of urban areas?
I think you need to customize the recommendations to each area. But it might be possible to walk on some days to school or to walk to other destinations. We know that children get activity both during the walk, and then they're also more likely to be active once they reach their destination. So those, combined with the fact that you're setting habits for life, are really a cumulative benefit of getting some walking in.
So, Andrea
and John, if I could just jump in here. I mean, I think that, you know, sometimes it isn't possible because the changes that need to be made are very long term. Like, you need to build a school closer to where you live. But sometimes it just means you should have a sidewalk. A lot of communities in America have no sidewalks. The streets are maybe 6 lanes wide, which make it very hard for a child to cross, and you can narrow the crossings and make them safer. So, you know, one of the things that's striking, though, is the extent to which even when people are close, they feel like it's the wrong thing to do to drive their children. And one of the most striking presentations I went to was about Newark, where they're trying to put in a safe routes to school. And even though Newark, New Jersey is an area where a lot of people walk, it's because they don't own cars. They can't afford cars. And as soon as people do buy cars, they will drive their children, even when it's only 2 blocks, because they think that is the safest way to get their child to school.
What are we expecting to do? What solutions do we have for this?
Well, I mean, I think that there's a lot of things that communities are doing. For example, there's the walking school bus model, where people actually get a group of maybe up to 20 children to stop and walk together to school. And we're seeing a lot of that. We're seeing some communities lower the speed limit around the schools, so cars will drive more slowly. We're having all kinds of, you know, sort of education awareness things. But it's a long, long, long haul, both because of the American infrastructure and because people are very used to driving. And one of the things I kept hearing was it's a long haul to get people to change their behaviors.
And Gina Lavasi, Associate Director of the Health and Society Scholars Program at Columbia University, I imagine if more kids start walking, they're going to be healthier all around, right?
Absolutely. And some of the environmental changes that could support safety will also support walking.
Thanks to Gina Lovasi. We're also joined by Takeaway correspondent Andrea Bernstein. It's National Walk to School Month, so get your kids out of the car and out onto the sidewalks.
So Berkeley told us what it's like when she walks to school there in Utah. Why don't you tell us what it looks like along your route? How did you get to school as a kid? Listeners, call in and tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. We're also hearing your stories this week. The Afghan war is 8 years long. The U.S. troop presence in Afghanistan turned 8 on Tuesday. Where should we be next year? Continue sending us your stories at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can send an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. If you missed anything, we're always here on The Takeaway. Take our podcast to go as you walk to school or anywhere else you walk. Subscribe now at thetakeaway.org or on iTunes.
I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.